Good afternoon. Welcome to this edition of the Rich Urban Show. We continue our series of interviews for the primary candidates here in West Virginia. Very happy to have Nate Kane on. He's running for the United States House of Representatives in the 2nd District, Congressional District here in West Virginia. So please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. And my name's Nate Kane. And people on the ballot, they'll see me as Dennis, quote, Nate Kane, and I go by my middle name, Nate. And I started off in the U.S. Army as a cybersecurity guy, and this was back in 97. I got out of the military after a few years and started working for the Navy and then the Marine Corps. So I've been, I think total years of service has been, you know, over 20 years working either as a soldier or as an enlisted or as a civil servant. Got into cybersecurity. I've been in that for 27 years total. I ended up going into work for myself, and I now own my own cybersecurity company, Kane & Associates, and we've done some pretty high-profile work, including work on election integrity after the 2020 election, both for the Trump White House as well as for the Thomas More Society and Amistad Project, and for Judge Gableman up in Wisconsin as well. So we've had, I've had a pretty good run, with my career, and things have been good. Kind of what's notable, I guess you could say, about me is most people have never heard my name before, but they may have heard about something that I was involved with. And that was back in 2018, I was working for the FBI and I became a federal whistleblower. In fact, the first ever FBI whistleblower to utilize the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act to blow the whistle on the FBI's cover-up of Hillary Clinton's crimes related to money laundering, public corruption, securities and exchange fraud, and terrorism financing. And this, a lot of this had to do with, especially the money laundering part, had to do with pay-to-play schemes like Uranium One was one of those that was part of that. It took about a year to get through that, and then the FBI raided my home. And so we had to, we went through quite a bit of a trial as a family. And then we ended up deciding to leave Maryland and move to West Virginia. And so we moved here to West Virginia in 2020, right after the 2020 election. The way I got into this race, I ended up deciding, after the 2020 election, after the 2022 election, seeing some of the same problems happening in that election, and that was very disappointing. I was pretty upset. And so I was praying and just asking the Lord to please raise up righteous men and women to run for office. And at that time, I heard that still small voice say, "What about you?" And so I really, at first I was kind of, well, Lord, I meant other righteous people, not me. And but I have my, my own successful business and things have been going really well. And, it's kind of like, why do I want to mess that up? And so so it was kind of a very difficult, decision, for me to do this. I had to, basically be assured that this was something that God wanted me to do. And so I asked the Lord to, give me a sign, and I kind of threw out a fleece to him. I didn't see any way that I could run. The state legislature was really kind of, not something that I could do. I didn't have the kind of time that I could take off to go to Charleston to work on things and then come back to work. And then the other part was there were some other statewide races that didn't really work for me because they required you to have been a resident for 5 years. And that includes even the Senate race for the federal position. So the only real race that made sense was the U.S. House of Representatives, but Mooney had just won re-election, and he won by like 70%. He had a very conservative voting record, and that didn't seem like, that seemed counterproductive. And so I just said, Lord, I don't see a path forward here. If you make a path, I'll run, but until then, I'm just going to wait. And I thought I bought myself 6 to 8 years with that, but the Lord has a sense of humor. And 2 days later, I was typing Alex Mooney's name into Google, and all of a sudden it drops down and it says, 2 seconds ago, Alex Mooney announces that he is running for the U.S. Senate in 2024.
Okay.
And my heart kind of sank because I knew what that meant. So even still, I knew I needed more confirmation. And so I just prayed. I said, God, I need more confirmation. And within 2 days, I had two friends that called me and just out of the blue asked me if I had ever thought about running for office. And then I decided to call my stepmom and talk to her and just, you know, ask for some advice. And before I could even get the words out of my mouth, I called her. I said, hey, I have something I want to talk to you about. She goes, what are you thinking of running for office? And so, you know, after that, I realized I can't keep running from this. I'm going to have to, you know, going to have to obey. And so I really started this as a reluctant candidate. But somewhere along the lines, things changed. And what really happened was, we were down in Petersburg, which is in Grant County. And while we were there, there was a couple that came up after a speech that I gave. At a arts center. We had a pretty decent turnout, which was kind of surprising that early on, but about 40 people. And this couple came up afterwards and they asked me if they could pray for me. And so I said, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, we kind of went outside and they just laid hands on me and they started praying for me. And afterwards they said something to me that I guess forever changed my perception of this whole thing. They said that they were part of a group of pastors that prays, and they had been praying for the last 5 years every week, praying for our nation, praying for our state, in particular praying for God to raise up righteous men and women to run for office and to, you know, to stand up to be leaders in our state. And they believed that God was answering that prayer through me running. And so I realized that this was much bigger than just Nate Kane and what I want for my life and, you know, what I want to do. This was about all those people, thousands of them. And we've met many, many more who have made the same claims that, you know, that they've been praying for years, asking God to raise up righteous leaders and that they finally feel like God is answering that call and that prayer. And so it's pretty hard to not want to do this when you believe that, you know, God is called you to do this. And so, and then to know that many people have been praying, I'm now praying that I win, not because I want to win and because I want to be in politics. I'm praying that I win because I truly do want people's prayers to be answered. And I want to see what God is going to do in West Virginia and in our country. I think that my campaign has been a very different one. It's definitely, you know, it is an unsurmountable uphill battle that I have. But I have faith and I know, you know, all of the stories, and that's just the things in my own life, but not just the things in my life, all those biblical stories about, you know, Gideon's army and, and the people of, you know, of Israel, you know, crossing over the Red Sea. And, you know, I'm sure there's all of these crazy things that we think by man standards can't happen. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that, you know, I refused to take PAC money, and that's because I prayed and the Lord said, don't do it. So I said, okay, so I won't take any PAC money. But yet we've still raised over $100,000 from, you know, individual donors all across the country. In fact, 40 different states. Mm-hmm. We have my opponent on the other hand, there's five of us in this race, but one of my opponents, the one that's probably the front runner, the biggest contender, you know, he has almost $2 million and he's been spending that money. And, because I haven't had that kind of money, it's forced me to go out there and be a better candidate and actually go out and knock on doors and talk to people and go to senior citizen centers and go to churches and go to, you know, people's homes and their living rooms and meet with their friends. And so my campaign has been much more about a word of mouth campaign, and you know, and that's powerful. And it's we've been everywhere we've gone, we've found God's favor, and so I feel really good about our campaign. And no matter what, the other thing that kind of happened was Memorial Day weekend. I had a dream, and it was so powerful that I woke up in tears, And I've never had that happen to me before. But in this dream, God was making it clear that if I focused on serving the people, that he would do the rest and I didn't need to worry about striving. And so we've made our campaign about that. We've focused on serving the people and their needs right now in their communities and the things going on. And some people have even said to me, well, Nate, that's not a federal issue. Why are you working on that? That's a state issue. Well, it doesn't matter, you know, because I'm doing what I can to help people now. And even if, you know, Lord willing, I get elected, I still have a responsibility to represent the people. And if some people are reaching out to me and they're contacting me saying, hey, we're having problems with our water, or we're having problems with, you know, this issue or that issue, even if it's a state issue, you know, it would be, you know, it would be righteous of me to take that issue to the delegates in the state legislature and say, hey, you know, I'm getting reached out to by these folks. What can, you know, what can I do to help you make this happen? You know, do you need me to remove some, you know, regulatory burden at the federal level? Do you need, you know, some public funds and, you know, grant money to fix some of these roads or some of these bridges? What is it that I can do to help? And that's what representation is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be, you know, about just going down there and making your conservative vote and then you never go back to your district.
Right.
A true representative should be in the district as much as possible and talking to the people and being held accountable.
Okay. So. Amen. Wow. Great testimony. So what do you think the biggest issue facing our country right now is? What would you say the biggest issue is?
I think, honestly, the biggest, most important issue that's got to be addressed is the abuse of power by our own government. I know that a lot of people see the border as a, you know, a bigger threat, and it certainly is a big threat. You know, our national security, with the military, is being as weak it is right now. That's a huge threat, but even bigger than that is the domestic threat. And right now we have a massive domestic threat because you have a Justice Department that is completely, you know, just gone off the rails. They've focused their attention, spying on American citizens using Section 702 of FISA.
Right.
It's obvious by the fact that Congress just voted to extend FISA and to give more money towards the FBI building a bigger building than the Pentagon. It's obvious to me that many of these members of Congress are compromised, and probably many of our judges are too. And I believe our intelligence community, I love our intelligence community, but at the same time, the intelligence community, if it's not operating the right way, is extremely dangerous. And I think it's more of a threat to our Constitution and to the survival of our nation than even foreign aggressors.
Okay. So you work, I saw that you worked for FBI. You worked like full time. You were like a contractor.
Yes. I was a contractor with the FBI. And prior to that, I was with Marfor Cyber as a civilian employee, and we were detached to NSA. So I was part of the intelligence community with NSA.
Okay.
And I've seen such an abuse of these surveillance tools on American citizens. That and then also too, just seeing, you know, the expansion of executive orders and, you know, and judges legislating from the bench and things like that, I really feel like our republic is in peril. And yes. So I think we have to get that, you know, together. We've got to get that in order. If we keep heading down the road we're heading down, you know, we're on the road to civil war because we're becoming more and more divided. It's clear that the intelligence community is running, I think, many of our media outlets, many of our social media companies, and I see that as a huge threat. Second to that would be, I think, you know, our national security in regards to China and their threat. There's many, many people who are, you know, a lot smarter and a lot more educated than I am, that have made very public statements about how the next biggest threat to our country is a cyber warfare attack. And I do think that that is coming. I think that the evidence shows that China has been doing nothing but probing us for the last decade.
Yeah. If I might interject, do you think that the ship knocking down the Francis Scott Key Bridge, some say that was a cyber attack. Do you have any opinion on that?
Yes. So I will tell you, I started a company called Blue Planet Cyber right before COVID hit, and the company was not able to take off because the whole shipping industry shut down. But our stated goal, our mission as a company was to go after cybersecurity contracts with the shipping industry because it was completely vulnerable. And in fact, we did a lot of research into this, a lot of research into the IT and OT systems. Most of my cybersecurity career has centered around the U.S. Navy, and I'm very familiar with the types of onboard ship systems that there are. And I will tell you that there's a lot of vulnerabilities there. I've seen hackers during demonstrations on simulations, sink a ship within an hour by basically flooding the ballast tanks of one side of the ship and emptying them out on the other. So it lists. I've seen them access the OT systems through the satellite dish and basically get into the IT systems, and then they find a way
OT,
into
does that mean
the operation.
navigation? What's OT system?
OT is operational
Okay.
technology, whereas IT is your information technology. So the difference is like what controls steering, what controls throttle, what controls ballast, things like that. That's all OT. And it was always thought that those things were air-gapped from the IT systems. And so, it used to be everything was analog, right? So if you steered the ship, there was linkage going all the way back to the rudder. That's not the case today. Today, everything is digitally controlled. So you may turn something, but it's using digital communications to turn it back at the rear end of the ship, or same thing with throttle and the engines and all of that. And so I believe the likelihood of it being a cyber attack on that ship is very high. But I also know that there's no way the government would ever allow that to get out into the media. And so they have a almost a responsibility to cover it up because it shows a massive threat, to our, shipping industry. And if a single cargo ship, flying under a foreign flag can take out a bridge, it can completely disrupt commerce and, a whole lot of other things. And so, the commercial, this is going to be the biggest threat. I mean, we've seen all of these manufacturing plants burning up. We've seen, if you remember the farm last year, the dairy farm that burned up, I think 1,500 head of cattle. I did some research into that because some of the projects that I worked on when I was with NSA looked awfully familiar, and in terms of risk assessment. And so I looked at that farm, and there was an expose on them the year before in a trade journal that showed how they were basically doing an expose on how wonderful this farm was because they had automated everything. And so, they had gone to automated, they were making generating their own methane from the cow dung. They had these automatic dung scoopers that would go behind the cattle and pick it up and process it to turn it into methane that they were burning to create electricity. And so I this expose, it showed the equipment on there. And so I was actually able to go and see what known vulnerabilities there were against that equipment. And there were some pretty major vulnerabilities. And a lot of times that kind of equipment doesn't get updated, immediately after a patch is released. Oftentimes it takes months, even years to get something like that patched. And so I suspect that that was a cyber attack. And I think there's been a lot of things that have been due to cyber attacks, but I think it's only going to get worse. And so I think having somebody in Congress with that knowledge is going to be a good thing.
All right. Let's talk, go on a couple other issues. Some things that are dear to my heart I want to ask you about. So I work with like youth-centered, absence-centered education for youth. But anyway, I'm of the opinion that pretty much all the different issues we have, you're talking about like military stuff, maybe not that, but in general, the societal issues are due to the fact that, like in West Virginia, 47% of births are outside of marriage. So my premise is that the fact that, children aren't growing up in stable two-parent families is driving pretty much all of the decline of society. Would you agree, disagree, or do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I believe that the this is my opinion on public policy on how that works. I think that as generally as American citizens, we should have freedom as much as possible. But the government does have a responsibility to promote those things that are generally good for society, good for families, and they should not be promoting those things that are opposed to that. The LGBTQ movement being one of those things, they absolutely should be out of the game of promoting those kinds of lifestyles or behaviors. They're not helpful to society. They certainly don't encourage the reproduction of future taxpayers or the healthy development of human beings. And so I think that regardless of what somebody's religious beliefs, and I'm a Christian, and so I have a Christian worldview, but even if somebody was not a Christian, I think the argument could be made that science has shown that children are healthiest when they grow up in a two-parent household of both a mother and a father. And I do agree with you that the government should be in the business of promoting that sort of thing. And so when they're creating laws, when they're looking at things like taxes and tax policy, they should be doing things that promote marriage, that promote families staying together, that promote the raising of children, not doing things that create, that work against that. And that's my opinion. Okay. I also realize that, a lot of our social ills are really spiritually based problems. And so, I am, again, I think that we have a need, that for some reason, somewhere along the lines, we got off track as a nation where we started thinking, instead of the church doing the charity work, instead of the church doing those things that traditionally were part of their purpose of existing, we started thinking that it was the government's job to do those things. And, the government doesn't have altruistic, reasons or motives right. for doing things. And so I think we have to get back to moving, things like, basically getting away from, some of the public welfare services and things like that that they've been doing, and allow, the community and allow the churches to, to take on that burden. Okay. I think that would help society a lot because, their motivations, I think, are much more altruistic. It's not driven by, by money. It's not driven by the same things that drives, the market economy, if you will, or even, the political realm.
Okay. You've mentioned some of these things, but just to clarify or get your opinion on them, I mean, they're related. So if you were in the House of Representatives, say, back in 2020 when they were investigating, or on January 6th, when they were voting or talking about whether to investigate election fraud in certain states, would you have voted to investigate election fraud? And then the second part of the question is, when the protests happened on January 6th, a lot of people are still in jail, and amazingly, they're still rounding up people. What's your take on that? What's going on there?
So without any doubt, I worked on election integrity work in the 2020, after 2020 election was over, and I saw plenty of evidence of election fraud, including massive amounts of counterfeit ballots that were being introduced into the election. This would have been after they shut down the counting, at midnight, sent everybody and all the poll watchers home. And that's why when we came back in the morning, the numbers had flipped. The reality is, that this happened, and unfortunately, we are where we are. If I was back then, and if I had the ability to have done something, there's no way that I would have voted for certification of the election. I would have not have voted for the certification of the election so long as the states that had ongoing investigations had not completed their investigations. We could have moved, and this was my biggest gripe against, Pence was that he could have delayed the certification of the election for another month until we had, more certainty about some of these things. I think that, for example, especially in the case of Pennsylvania, that's a perfect example because the courts even agreed that the governor had no right to accept ballots that were put you know, after the close of the, you know, the polls, and that that was actually unconstitutional by him to change the rules. He was not part of the legislature. And, the courts, you know, it had that been adjudicated before, it would have completely turned out, changed the outcome of the election, because they would have had to discount, you know, well over 1,000 ballots, and Trump would have won, those electoral votes in Pennsylvania. So, you know, there were things that happened there that should not have happened. January 6th is a whole nother issue. And I am, very disturbed by what I've seen with the current Justice Department. Our Constitution is so clear, couldn't be clearer, that we have a right to assemble, to, you know, peaceably, which 99% of the people there were peaceful, but we have a right to assemble to make our grievances known to our government. And that is exactly what the people were doing that day. It's clear and obvious that Nancy Pelosi, in conjunction with Yogananda De Pittman, you know, who was running the Capitol Police at the time, that they, and probably along with even maybe some people in the FBI, orchestrated and planned a lot of the activity that was going on with, you know, some of these more violent protesters. Mm-hmm. And they've misused, they've committed prosecutorial misconduct in the way that they've conducted themselves in relation to, you know, the trials that have been held there. You have people that have been kept in jail for over 3 years now. They've been denied religious services. They've been denied due process. They've been denied their right to bail. All of these things, by the way, guaranteed to us in the Constitution. They have been denied a fair, they've been denied a speedy trial or a trial by their peers. There have been multiple cases where the juries are being basically reused over and over again. That's also illegal and unconstitutional. And I believe that most of these judges in these cases are completely corrupt. I think that Donald Trump, on day one of his presidency, he needs to pardon every single person who is in prison on January 6th, because I don't believe that any one of them got a fair trial. Not one of them. That's okay. My opinion.
That's, amen. That's clear opinion. Thanks for that. On some other issues, like, is the current level of government spending sustainable? Would you have, for instance, voted for that $60 billion to Ukraine, as well as money for Israel and Taiwan? And then also there was the $1.2 trillion in March, I guess, for the rest of the year budget for like half of the government. What's your take on that?
So I have a real problem with a lot of the foreign aid that we have going out right now. I do not believe that any of this is sustainable. I was opposed to the Ukraine aid packages from the very get-go, and I've been very outspoken against it, mainly because, you know, number one, we're not even giving our own money. We're borrowing money to give to all of these other countries, and we're borrowing that money from China. So when we borrow money and we give it to a foreigner, that is essentially the same as if, you know, if I were to go and say, you know, find a bunch of my neighbors and forcibly take their credit cards and then go pull cash out, you know, on their credit cards and give them their credit cards back and then take that cash and go give it to a homeless man. I mean, that's basically, you know, to put it in a very kind of realistic sense of what we might see, you know, today, that's what it is. They're borrowing money on the future generations of this nation,
right,
in order to give it to somebody who's not even family. They're, you know, the Ukraine, they're not an ally. We have no treaty with them. We don't have any kind of, allegiance. The only thing that I see is a bunch of corruption, and a bunch of unaccountability in regards to how that money has been spent. We've seen that they've used it for lavish trips and additional houses and sports cars and things like that. Nobody knows where this money's going. I'm also, quite honestly, I'm opposed to foreign aid going to even countries that I love and that I believe we do have a responsibility to support, like Israel. I'm all for us selling arms to them. You know, don't get me wrong. I think we should sell as many arms to them as they need. And I'm even okay with us, you know, providing some aid. But I don't think that we should be giving money to anybody. I think that especially when it's borrowed money, that's just, that doesn't make any sense. I don't think that's righteous. I think that we've got a major problem with spending in Washington. And I think the best way that we can reduce that spending and, you know, and cut back on it is we've got to cut the foreign aid. Number one. Number two, we need to shrink the size of the federal government. I'm not a monster. I realize there's a lot of people that depend on their government jobs, and I realize that you got to be able to win over enough moderates in the House and in the Senate in order to get the, you know, get a bill passed. And so what I would propose is I would propose that we shrink the size of government through attrition. I don't know how anybody could, you know, make an argument against that, to where we say anybody that retires or anybody that leaves federal office, we're not going to fill their positions. We're not going to create any new positions in many of these agencies, and most of them, in fact. And we're going
would
to
that make a big dent? Would it make a dent of 5% or 10%, or has any been study been done or anything?
I don't know if a study's been done, but I know that the, you know, the one of the things that there's been a lot of talk about is that the baby boomers are all getting ready to retire. So, you know, that is, and they're in that process of retiring. So I would say that that would probably would make a significant dent, even if it was just 10%. I mean, 10% is 10%.
Yeah.
And I'm a believer that, you know, that the Democrats, they seem to understand really well how to get things done. They do things by moving the goalposts. And I think we've got to use that same tactic. Start with something that they would be very, it would be very difficult for them to defend going against, like, you know, shrinking the size of the government through attrition, you know, and then once you get that and they get used to the idea, oh, it's okay, you know, to not just keep increasing the size of the government, then we start working on, okay, now what agencies don't we need? And can we, you know, basically riff those employees and move them to other agencies and start, you know, shrinking the size of that agency. And so to me, it's going to take time. But I think it can be done, and I think it needs to be done in a kind of graduated way, so that you're kind of moving the goalposts and not disrupting the political culture so much that you get just instant no's, but you get people actually agreeing to go along with it, and eventually, you know, you get the change that you want.
Okay, that's very reasonable. On the issue that's mostly state issue, but also federal. Do you believe in and support like what's called medical freedom or vaccination choice? And there is a federal issue involved, of course, with the 1986 act that took away liability for pharma. And of course, in West Virginia, we have the, which again, I know is a state issue, but anyway, it's all interrelated. We have, you know, the no vaccination, no school policy. Anyway, what's your opinion on that?
So I am 100% for medical freedom when it comes to vaccines. I absolutely do not agree that the government has any right, any business telling you what you can and cannot put in your body. I also believe that no business has a right to know, you know, what vaccines that you have. I mean, we have HIPAA laws for this. And the federal government, I think, committed a violation, you know, of your Fourth Amendment when they, you know, instituted this vaccine mandate, because what it does say is it says that, you know, our most sacred, you know, area of privacy, if you will, is it says, you know, there cannot be any kind of intrusion into our papers, our bodies, our, you know, basically our persons, you know, without probable cause. And the government does not have probable cause to go looking into what vaccines I have, what vaccines I don't have, period. Mm. So that's a Fourth Amendment violation, number one. Right. And it's also a First Amendment violation in every case where somebody was compelled to do this against their religious, you know, beliefs. And in my personal belief, this was a test, if you will, to see how far they could push us to do what we didn't want to do. And it reminds me of the scriptures where it talks about the, you know, the mark of the beast, and how there will come a time where people will have to take the mark of the beast. And if they refuse, they will not be able to work. They will not be able to buy and sell. Mm, yeah. And this was exactly like that. Now, was this the mark of the beast? No. But to me, this was a test of my resolve. And so when I wrote a religious exemption for myself, that was the basis of it. I said, I am not going to begin to give in, you know, to this kind of pressure, you know, to do something that, you know, goes against my conscience. And I said, and so I wrote that that would be essentially weakening my resolve for, you know, the end times. And eventually I was told that I could not keep my job if I was going to not get vaccinated. And so I told them, well, then I'm out of here. And that's why I started my own cybersecurity company. And so I'm very much opposed to it. Now, I do want to make something clear, though. It's important that we remember that the government does have some say in certain things. And I do believe, for example, that the government does have a right to say, we are not going to allow for medical mutilation of children. Right. We're not going to allow for, you know, for hormone blockers on minors.
Right.
And so that's where I draw the line is, for adults, I believe it's absolutely the right of adults to, you know, live their lives however they want. They want to get a, you know, mutilate their body, be my guest, but you don't get to do that to kids. Now, when it comes to vaccines is another issue, though. That, again, there's been plenty of evidence that these vaccines oftentimes come with risks.
Right.
And risk management decisions for your children are 100% the right of the parent, not the right of the schools. And until they can show me a VAERS report where there's not a single instance of, you know, somebody, you know, having some sort of adverse reaction, then the school doesn't get to say that that you have to have that vaccine. But the fact is that every single vaccine has a number of people who have adverse reactions. Right. And so it's a risk.
Yeah, none have ever been actually tested against a, you know, double blind placebo. Okay, well, as you're coming toward the end of our interview, just anything you'd like to share that we haven't touched on. And, you know, you mentioned a little, but if you want to further or more, you know, or differentiate yourself from your opponents, feel free. Okay, go ahead.
Sure. So I think the biggest thing that separates me from my opponents, look, that most of the guys that are running in this race, I think they are, you know, genuinely good guys. I think that they, you know, they're conservative. They want to do good for their country. What separates me is, number one, I didn't get into this race because I wanted to be a politician. I didn't get into this race because I wanted to, you know, gain power or try to do anything on my own strength. I got into this race because I felt God calling me to. I do think that matters. I think that to think that you're going to be able to go in there and make change without the providence of God, I think is pretty arrogant. And I realize and recognize I'm going to need God's help. I think that's one of the things that separates me. Another thing that separates me is that I am a former FBI whistleblower. I'm also somebody who's blown the whistle on election integrity issues as well. And I, you know, it's shown that I have integrity and that I'm willing to lose everything in order to do the right thing. And we need people in Congress, especially with as corrupt as Congress is today. We need people who are going to go in there and be courageous and who are going to do the right thing, no matter what it costs them, and who are willing to sacrifice. And that is something that I've already proven that I am willing to do, is to sacrifice, you know, for the sake of my country and for the oath that I've taken. The other thing that and I would say those two main things are what differentiate me. I live my faith. You know, my campaign actually operates on the basis of what I believe. And so I don't lie. When you see, you know, when I write something or I put some post out there, I don't make claims that I'm going to on day one go and shut the border, because I know that's not a possibility. That it takes, you know, it takes a majority of Congress to get things done. And there are things that are executive roles and things that are roles for the Congress. I don't tell people that I'm the only conservative. I don't tell people that I'm the only pro-life. I don't tell people that I'm the only candidate that supports Trump. All of the other candidates have done those types of things in their advertising. I will not do it, because I believe that honesty matters and integrity matters. I think character counts, and it's extremely important in this election, because until we start to see, you know, our leaders have character, nothing is going to change. And the last thing I guess I would want to say to people is that I hope that people will vote for me. And I hope that people will, you know, go check out my webpage. They can find that at natecainforwv.com. That's N-A-T-E-C-A-I-N, the number four, WV.com. But at the same time, more than that, you know, it's not going to matter if I get elected or if Trump gets elected and we don't have the blessings of God. In fact, if we want to see our country turn around, we have to recognize what our founders understood, which is that our country cannot survive without the blessings of providence and without God's help. And that's what we need. And so I would ask that people please not only pray about these elections, not only pray for godly leaders, but please pray for a revival in this nation.
Amen. Okay, well stated. Well, I really thank you for coming on today. We'll get this out on a podcast and on any podcast at the Richard Urban Show or on visionroot.org. We'll have the video too. And yeah, I appreciate, you know, your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it, and God bless you. God bless.